Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 5th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Worship and Its Arts. Are the arts a diaphora? Our presenter is Paul Bosch, session number BOP 2006-06. Let's listen in.
Hymn 340. Can you share your hymn book?
Yes.
Did we sing this the other day? 340, Jesus Christ, my sure defense. Jesu meine Zuversicht.
Yeah, I think.
We did.
You did.
We should sing something else then.
Oh.
How about?
Okay, young girl.
Oh, there's another favorite of mine that we'll sing tomorrow night.
Let's
sing 340,
Paul.
Let's sing 340?
Yeah.
Yes.
We got a new population? All right, sure, let's do it.
Okay.
It's not as if I've had a one-track mind or anything. Okay, take a look at this second stanza.
Uh-oh, do I have to hold it?
Jesus, my Redeemer, lives. I, too, unto life shall waken. He will bring me where he is. Shall my courage then be shaken? Shall I fear, or could the head rise and leave his members dead? Isn't that wonderful? We'll sing just the first two stanzas, okay?
Jesus Christ, my sure defense, and my Savior ever liveth. No.
Stuff, huh?
Uh-huh.
That's real, what'll I say? That is real meat, it seems to me, for the human soul. And the happy clappy stuff that we hear a lot of times in some praise churches doesn't quite cut it. Well,
do you have a bias?
What's that?
Do you have a bias, Paul? Just checking.
I still missed it.
Do you have a bias?
A buyer.
A bias.
B-I-A-S. Bias.
Oh, no bias. Never. Okay, moving along. Let me give you some wonderful quotes here. First of all, fides qua or fides qui. Fides, well, I should write that out so you know what I'm talking about. Fides qua. And fides qui, that's Latin, needless to say, faith in what or faith in who. And we was never confused the two. We believe in Jesus, is that right? Jesus as the Christ, the human face of God, another way of putting it. But because of that then, there are certain fides qua, certain stuff that we believe, and that's spelled out in the creed. And the creed, I would say, is culture-bound. I mean, it depends on the situation in which it's written. So we have to understand the creed in the same way that we understand Bible texts, that is to say, contextually. We have to understand liturgy, worship, contextually too. I should point out that I have the new draft copy of the new hymnal with the indexes. The indexes are separate here. The new book will not be this big. It'll be small. It'll fit into the pew rack. This is cheap paper. This is the draft copy, so it's on cheap paper and it's too thick. But it's going to have 10 services of Holy Communion, going to have the small catechism, going to have all the psalms, going to be wonderful. This is the book also that I recommended that the bookstore carry for this series of presentations, and thereby an Episcopal dean of the cathedral in Philadelphia, Repitching the Tent and Creating Uncommon Worship. And it is very radical and egalitarian. Do you know that word, egalitarian? Equal. No hierarchy. Very, very radical. Anyhow, fides qui and fides qua is a useful distinction. And then Goethe, G-O-E-T-H-E, the famous German Shakespeare, you might say, he says something like this, and I wish I had the exact quote because he says it very elegantly. He says, it's our job to focus on the externals, to focus on the externals in faith or in worship or in whatever, until, having focused on that sufficiently, we are given the grace to see the substance and to grasp the substance. And I like that. And what you're dealing with here in these sessions is the externals, quite frankly. But I hope that over the course of time, by focusing on those externals, we will be given the grace to grasp the substance. What's there in the substance? Now, the externals are also sometimes given the word adiaphora. Have you seen that word before? A-D-I-A-P-H-O-R-A. That is a Greek word, and it means stuff that is neither commanded nor rejected, but of, what will I say?
Nebulous character.
What's the word?
Nebulous character.
Nebulous.
Well, nebulous may not be the word, but anyhow, it's not the works. The Lutheran confession say something like this: that human rights and liturgies and organizational patterns of church life and so on, they are adiaphora. That is to say, they are not commanded in the Bible. They're not rejected in the Bible. They're of human invention, rather than, it doesn't mean that they're not important, though. This is my argument today and in this session. That is to say, all of these things also speak and are part of the word. My argument is going to be that the way you arrange your space, the way you gesture, whether you use wine or grape juice, stuff like that makes a difference and communicates and speaks a word, and sometimes speaks that word more compellingly than the words of our sermon. I quoted several times in the last several days the statistic that 55% of everything you learn about me when you first meet me is nonverbal. How I stand, how I sit, whether I smile, whether I frown, that kind of thing. 38% on top of that 55% is still not the words, not the meaning of the words, but vocal. How I'm speaking in a shout or in a gentle tone of voice. That's vocal. Think of training a puppy or training a little preschooler, toddler who can't speak English yet. What's left? 55 plus 38, 7% is the actual cognitive meaning of my verbalizations, my words. And as I have said several times already, in the people who have followed me through these couple of weeks, that should give a preacher nightmares. And it should give a teacher nightmares, and it should give a parent nightmares. That is to say, we ought to be conscious of all of the nonverbal stuff that goes along with the verbal. Wonderful story my wife used to tell. My wife was in family child studies, how to talk so kids will listen, how to listen so kids will talk, parent effectiveness training. You've heard of that kind of stuff? She used to come here to hold it with me, and she would lead sessions with those topics. Anyhow, she told the story that she had heard somewhere of a visitor to a foreign country. I think it was Latin America. The visitor did not know the language. He was with a guide, interpreter, who did know the language. And they came upon, in a big city, they came upon a sidewalk preacher in the city park. And the sidewalk preacher was pounding his fist into his hand and wagging his finger at the crowd and shouting at them with abrasive shouts and frowning at them. And the guy who didn't know the language turned to the interpreter and said, "What's the fellow preaching?" And the interpreter said, "Love." It happens all the time on Sunday mornings, friends. Well, not all the time, let us hope, but I mean, it happens often enough that our nonverbals sometimes betray our verbals. Okay, moving along. That was Goethe. Here's a wonderful quote from Augustine. Faith is loyalty to the intangibles. I like that. The definition of faith, one among many, would be loyalty to the intangibles. And then let us think in terms of the two sincerities. There is a sincerity that comes along with spontaneously speaking what's on your heart and being relatively eloquent with it. There's another sincerity, equally sincere, that comes from reading somebody else's words and endorsing them. Nathan Hale, standing up, I regret that I have but one life to give for my country. I mean, I doubt that he sat up the night before and, penned that out very carefully. I regret, is that the word I want? No, maybe I want the word. I mean, you can't imagine Nathan Hale doing that. He just got up there and he said, "I regret that I have but one life to give for my country." That's spontaneous sincerity. But there's another sincerity that is equally sincere and equally authentic and equally good and equally praiseworthy that comes from reading somebody else's words and saying, "I endorse them." Would you agree with me? A lot of times people say, "Well, I don't like you Lutherans because you're always reading prayers out of a book." Well, there's something to be said for reading Thomas Cranmer's wonderful English. "O God, you have prepared for those who love you joys beyond understanding. Pour into our hearts such love for you that loving you above all things, we may obtain your promises which exceed all that we could ask or desire through Jesus Christ our Lord." Wow. That's Thomas Cranmer. And that's pretty good. And I memorized that when I was a seminarian. And I commend all seminarians here to memorize that kind of thing too. It'll come in very handy at the bedside, at a hospital, in visitation, whatever. Sometimes you have to depend on other people and endorse their words. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing insincere about that. So let us remember always the two sincerities. Now, our homework, as I have said in earlier sessions, involves part of the four C's: creed, code, cult, and constitution. Creed, that's what you believe, whether it's written down or not, whether it's a formal doctrine or a belief system. Everybody has beliefs. Code, that's ethical behavior. On the basis of what you believe, how do you act? How do you live? That's part of everybody's human package, it seems to me. Cult, that's what we're talking about here. And cult has to do with ritual. Liturgy, ceremony. And everybody has it. Whether it's at the golf course or wherever. Halftime at the Super Bowl. You can't tell me that isn't a ritual. Opening night of the symphony orchestra season. You can't tell me that's not a ritual. Patriotic parade on the 4th of July. You can't tell me that's not a ritual. People have rituals to enrich their lives. Even constitution, that's church order. As I have only partly jokingly said, Jesus says, where two or three are gathered together in his name, there he will be in their midst. And I think that's true, but there you will also find a president, a secretary, and a treasurer. That's just human life. Okay, we're dealing with ritual, and the difference between ritual and routine is important. Routine is something you do over and over again that you would not miss if you did not do it, like taking out the garbage. Ritual is something you, if you didn't do it, you would miss it. If you didn't, it's something you do over and over again that you would miss if you did not do it. That's ritual, good ritual. So we want to honor history and tradition, but we don't want to be antiquarian. We want to honor the creation and the culture, but we don't want to be elitist. I would even like to rescue the terms high church and low church for you. Are we high church? Sure. I'm high church. High in the sense of high competence, high excitement, high even at the in the sense of at the edges of perception and awareness. I want my worship to be high because I live in a culture where there's high education. A lot of people sitting out there in the pew have a better education than I do. So I want high stuff. Not because God needs it. There used to be this kind of, I wouldn't necessarily reject this notion, that God needs our highest and our best. I think God is pleased when we exhibit our highest and that's our best. But it's human beings who need it. Human beings are fed by high art, high language, high experience, and they are not fed by their opposites. Erasmus of Rotterdam, another quote for you. The arts do not save human beings, but they make human life worth saving. I kind of like that. So we should not be ashamed to be, quote unquote, high church. On the other hand, we should not be ashamed to be low church. What would I mean by low? Well, low in the sense of authentic, intimate, into the depths of human experience, human life. Am I low church? Sure. You don't have to put on special airs or special, pompous ways of acting when you're over here. On either side of the pulpit, or on either side of the chancel. Are we low church? Sure we are. Because we want to be authentic, we don't want to be a phony. We don't want to be a phony before God, we don't want to be a phony before other people. Okay, moving along. Liturgy is the work of the people. Have you heard the word liturgy taken apart? My Greek here is crazy, but anyhow, this means work. And this is... No, no, I'm doing that wrong. Trust me, it means the work of the people. I forget which is the root and which is the work and which is the people, but it means the work of the people. And in the original use of that word, it meant, for instance, the people doing their public work. For instance, as part of a citizen of Athens, I would have to help to build a road, let's say, or build a bridge. And that was my liturgia. That was part of my liturgy. And I like to think that that pertains also on Sunday morning. What you are doing is your public work. And it's public, it's corporate, it's not single. You're not all by yourself, you're with others, and you're doing God's work. You're doing God's work also out in the world, which brings me to recovering the prepositions in, with, and under. The Holy Communion. Have you ever thought of that term? What a lovely term that is. It means the holy, the possibility of the holy discerned in, with, and under the common. Holy, common, communion. You see that term? Have you heard that before? Here's another set of Latin for you. This one I do know. As an A. Finitus, est capax infiniti. That means God has made the world in such a way that the finite, finitus, is, E-S-T, capax, capable of the infinite. God has made his world in such a way that the finite, the stuff, the molecules of this world are capable of being a vehicle for a heavenly invasion of this world. Now that is the whole, our understanding of sacrament rests on that idea. That God has made the world in such a way that bread and wine and water can be vehicles of a heavenly invasion of your life. And beyond your life, the life of the world. That's good news to me. As a matter of fact, I don't think I would be a Christian without this notion. I quoted to you before John Updike, Roger's version. It's a novel. Are some of you fans of John Updike? I am, anyhow. He writes this book called Roger's Version, and Roger is a parish pastor who now has got a PhD, and he's teaching at a seminary. And as I quoted a couple of days ago now, his niece says, Uncle Roger, you used to be, or you're in sales, aren't you? And he says, well, I used to be in sales when I was in the parish, but now that I'm teaching at seminary, I'm in quality control. So these sessions are kind of quality control. We're talking shop here. But there's another wonderful part in this book where Roger is translating Tertullian. Roger at seminary now is a patristic scholar. That is to say, he studies these ancient teachers of the church, the fathers, patristics, fathers of the church. And Tertullian is one of them, and Tertullian writes a book called Concerning the Resurrection of the Flesh. And he asks this question, Tertullian, and I should say, Updike has these great paragraphs of church Latin where he translates, and says, well, the force of this verb is not quite like this, it's a little more like this. Wonderful stuff. Where he gets that, I do not know. Anyhow, where Updike, the author, gets it anyhow. Here is Tertullian translating the resurrection of the flesh, and he's asking the question, In the resurrection, will the soul need the body? Will the spirit need the flesh? Or will it leave the flesh, the body behind, and just be spiritualized, whatever that might mean? And Tertullian concludes, no, the spirit needs the body. The soul needs the flesh. And then there's this wonderful uptight parenthesis. Dear flesh, do come to the party. Signed, your pal, the soul. Isn't that nice? Anyhow, that's the kind of resurrection that I look forward to, a resurrection of the flesh, of the body. Incidentally, in the creed, you might also interpret that body, the body of Christ. I believe in the resurrection of the body. But I also like the idea of this stuff being resurrected. And that all has to do with finitus est capax infiniti. Okay, moving along. Are we still in this? Yes, we are. If the Holy Communion, then, is a time or a place or an occasion or a situation where we can discern the presence of the Holy, come on in, gals. If we can discern there the presence of the Holy in, with, and under the common, I think those are Melanchthon's prepositions, as a matter of fact. Melanchthon was a friend, as you may know, of Martin Luther, and he wrote part of the Book of Concord. He was a very more philosophical than Luther. Luther was very gut-oriented. But I like those prepositions. We have the presence of Christ in the sacrament in, with, and under the bread and the cup. And I'm saying this finitus est capax infiniti tells us that the presence of the Holy is possible in, with, and under the very common. What does it say in Romans 12? Present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Now, that means that the truest liturgy, the most important ritual, is your life. You are to present your body, your life, in such a way that it is a prayer. People should look at you, should be able to look at you and say, hey, that person is a living testimony to the God of Jesus. Pretty neat, I think. Present your bodies as a living sacrifice. You are to be a picture of God in this world. Martin Luther says, we are to live as Christs to each other. A lot of times you hear that translated, we are to be little Christs to each other. Well, I heard a Luther scholar say that there's no diminutive in Luther. It's not little Christ. It's just plain Christ. You want to see the Messiah? Look in the mirror. Look at the person sitting next to you, in the seat next to you. The truest liturgy, the best liturgy, the most God-pleasing liturgy is the liturgy of your life. And between what we do on Sunday morning and how you live your life the rest of the week, there should be no disjunction. There should be no... It should be all of a piece. So, if liturgy is... If your life is to be a liturgy, that shows the conjunction, I might say, between liturgy and justice, for instance. If you are to live your life as a Christian, then what we do on Sunday morning is a ritualization of that. Let me point out just one aspect of it. I said this, I think, a couple of days ago. At the communion, everybody gets the same quantity. Everybody gets a little bit of bread. Everybody gets a little bit of the wine. Nobody, if you're rich, you do not go away from that table with more than if you're poor. The poor and the rich get the same. I think that's a very important witness. It would be terrible if we ever lost that. The truest liturgy I have here is the act of loving service. And I said a couple of weeks ago, a couple of days ago, I guess it is now, it seems like weeks, what is the gospel all about? Well, you should be able to tell your friend, your atheist friend, your Buddhist or Hindu friend, come with me on Sunday morning and see it happen. Come with me on Sunday morning and see, take part in my ritualization of what I understand life to be all about. There'd be two polarities that I would want to point out. Revelation and religion. Revelation would be the message of God in Christ. That is to say, we know about God because we have seen Jesus. That's revelation. And somebody has to tell you that. It's nothing that you can invent. It's nothing that you can get from nature. Somebody has to tell you that. It could have been your parent, it could have been a pastor, it could have been a friend or a mentor, but somebody has to tell you. And most Protestants are very good at revelation. We are less good at religion, which is human beings trying to make sense of their lives and seeing to it that it is ritualized in a way that makes the revelation clear. I talked about the death of Marilyn Monroe a couple of days ago. The author whom I quoted said that the death of Marilyn Monroe represented the murder of Norma Jean Baker by Marilyn Monroe. And wasn't that a shame? That this little girl from Ohio who had a terrible background should be murdered, so to speak, by her embodiment, Marilyn Monroe. And revelation is always at the point of being murdered by religion. But it doesn't have to be that way. Religion can be, and we're stuck with religion, it seems to me. We have to have some way of ritualizing what we believe. And so the religious enterprise is always going to be with us. Okay, moving along. Who are these people who gather? Rich, poor, old and young, black and white, left wing and right wing, gay and straight. I mean, that is the Catholic Church, small c. And even the Roman Catholic Church has homework to do to make worship and their whole church life more Catholic, small c. And certainly Lutherans do, and Presbyterians and United Church and you name it. Every Christian church has a job to make its worship and its life more Catholic, small c. As one of the standards we talked about a couple of days ago, I suggested that when we try to reform our worship, we have six standards, or five is that I forget, biblical, Catholic, confessional, denominational, that is to say, national, parochial, personal. And this Catholic standard, again, we shouldn't be afraid of that word Catholic. It means universal, but it means more than universal. It means lacking in nothing, having everything there in front of it. Not not lacking in any part. I have some trouble, for that reason, with so-called targeted worship. We're going to have a worship just for baby boomers, or we're going to have a worship just for youth, or we're going to have the youth a service just for red-haired people. I mean, I'm getting ridiculous now, but you see the picture. That's not the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is everybody together in one place. Old and young, rich and poor, black and white, left political opinion and right political opinion. And that is the dickens of a job to pull off, quite frankly. If you're a pastor, it is a very difficult job to hold all those people in one community and to be able to preach to them and to be able to make a liturgy and pick out the hymns, you know, that satisfy everybody. You're going to have a dickens of a time, but I think that is your job. I think that is what's laid upon you, to have a Catholic congregation means to have all of those parties in front of you. And if you don't have them in front of you, you should invent them. You should pretend that they're there. Darius and I both served campus ministries for a long time. You're retired now, I dare say.
No, not yet.
Really? You're still in harness?
Yes.
Incredible. Well, we were in campus ministry, and you know, in campus ministry, I have, and he had too, people for four years in their life, let's say, in undergraduate years, sometimes a little bit more graduate school. But you had a lot of young people and not very many little kids and not very many old gray hairs. But I had to invent them and say, hey, those little kids and those old gray hairs, they belong here just as much as the kids do, just as much as the youth, the young people do. And sure enough, pretty soon, old gray hairs began to appear, and the little kids began to appear too. I mean, you had the parents who would visit. You would have graduate students who would themselves then have families and bring their little kids, that kind of thing. You're going to ask a question? Feel free to interrupt me here anywhere along the line. Okay. Gathering, washing, hearing, eating. Baptism. This was a nice thought. I hadn't thought of this before. But as soon as the early church began to baptize, instead of circumcise, the fight, the battle against women being ordained was lost. Would you agree with me? I mean, to be a Jew, you had to be a male. You had to be circumcised. And women were second class. I'm not sure how that is today, how the Jews work that out today. But anyhow, as soon as the Christian church began to baptize, instead of circumcise, then it was over. The fight against women's ordination was over. Women take their place along with men. Gentiles, uncircumcised Gentiles, take their place alongside the circumcised Jews. Little kids, they were not highly regarded in Jesus' day. Jesus invited all these people into his fellowship, into his community. He had very good words to say about the Roman centurion. He had very good words to say about the woman at the well, who's not a Jew. She's a Samaritan. She's kind of a half-breed. So Jesus is our model there, and is a model of, quote-unquote, Catholic inclusivity. Inclusive Catholic Church. Okay. The chief... Well, we should probably get to that tomorrow, but well, or next time. The chief artifactual signs and the chief architectural signs in worship are font, altar, table, and ambo, lectern, pulpit. We'll get to architecture tomorrow. But meantime, is it time to take a little break? Talk to your neighbor for a minute and see if any of this makes sense, and then we'll have a little discussion. Go ahead.
Your neighbors to make
talk to your neighbor for 1 minute. I'll time you.
Sure. Oh, good note taker.
I have a question. If baptism was the thing that brought women into the pulpit and that sort of thing, why did it take so long for them to be...
Good point. We're just stupid. That's my answer. It just took that long for us to get the point. 2,000 years practically, right? Terrible. What does Paul say? In Christ there is no Jew or Greek. By Greek he means uncircumcised. Gentile. There is no Jew or Gentile. There is no
male
or female. There is no slave or free. And, you know, we should have got that point long ago, but we didn't.
He also said women should be silent in the church.
Ha-ha. Now, there's a point.
So there goes all your Sunday school teachers.
I heard a wonderful teacher say this. Wherever you hear a negative proscription, it always implies a previous positive practice. Think about that. When St. Paul says, no women should speak in church, what does that imply? Women were speaking in church, right?
Yes.
And Paul is trying to put the damper on women speaking in church because he thinks that would be an offense to the Gentiles, who didn't either think that women were very important. But the fact that he had to say that signifies to me and to people like Elizabeth Fiorenza, Schussler Fiorenza, you know her,
yeah.
a woman theologian. She says that this is one indication that women were exercising roles of leadership in the early church. And dear friends, who is the first evangelist of the resurrection?
Mary Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene, a woman. It's not Peter. It's not James or John. It's Mary who comes to the tomb, sees the risen Christ, go back and tell the disciple. So, wherever you hear that kind of a negative prescription, it always is implying that something was going on ahead of time that he had to say that. The opposite of it. I'm not sure that convinces you.
Well, it convinces me, but it seems like, in particular in the Catholic Church, and the Lutheran Church way back weren't listening to that at all.
It wouldn't have entered our mind. It wouldn't have entered our thought. But the 1960s, as I said the 1960s saw a wonderful, explosion of all kinds of liberation movements, including civil rights movements. You know, how long did it take us to accept blacks in our churches? How long did it take Christian people to understand that black people were not subhuman? If you read Abraham Lincoln, you can find that he had a terrible, at least at the beginning, a terrible view of blacks. I'm not sure he says that these are really human beings like us white folks. But then he converted, of course. He changed his mind, and he opened the doors, you know, with the Emancipation Proclamation. So it just takes sometimes a long, long time for us to get the message. That would be my answer. Go ahead.
Just a semantics thing. You said that at the time that we began to baptize rather than circumcise, that the battle over women's ordination was lost. Do you mean lost,
the battle,
won, or over?
The fight was
Lost implied, you know.
The wind was taken out of the sails of the people who oppose women's ordination. That's what I meant to say. The people who oppose women's ordination do not have a case, in my view, ever since we started to baptize instead of circumcise.
And we always baptize male and female, right? I mean, from the beginning.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think there would even be Bible scholars who say that we baptize children from the beginning, too. The whole household of Cornelius or whatever. Mm-hmm. Something else? Don't be shy. Go ahead.
What you just said fits into, it's just a little aside, fits into a button that some of my dear Benedictine sisters wear that says, if you're not going to ordain us, don't baptize us.
Don't what?
Don't baptize us.
If you're not going to ordain us, don't baptize us.
Ooh.
It fits into what you're saying. But they wear those buttons and a few of them in this kind of radical statement against the
Jews. Well, to follow up on that, really, what is ordination? But it is a specific calling of our baptism. I've heard people make very clearly that it's baptism which is our ordination.
Very good. Very good. And this fellow who writes this book makes that point. Mm-hmm. We are baptized into our ordination as Christians. I'm supposed to be Christ to you because of my baptism. You're supposed to be Christ to me. You're supposed to be Christ to each other. You're even supposed to be Christ to your enemy. Something else? I suppose I owe it to you to say a word about that teaser, Holden Village's Dirty Little Secret.
Yeah.
That was to get you in the door. I kind of wish I hadn't put it that way now. But I've been at Holden as early as 1970. At a student conference. Were you at that student conference then, by chance?
Nope.
Every year, the National Lutheran Students have a conference, and it was here. And my wife and I fell in love with the place. Our kids were little. They loved it. We came back on successive years. Not every year, but I'll bet we were here 10 times out of, 30 years? Anyhow, I anguished and anguished for the last months about whether I should bring this up now. And I anguished again yesterday, which was my day off, and I rewrote my speech. You see how I got it all cut into pieces here. And I spent some time with Elaine this morning and anguished and beat my breast again. It seems to me that that what we find at Holden is a picture of a deep, could I even call it a deep divide? I think I would. I would be willing to say that. A deep divide between old ALC piety and old LCA piety. Now, you won't know what I'm talking about. Cliff here is United Church, so he doesn't know all this crazy Lutheran stuff. And ultimately, the crazy Lutheran stuff doesn't make much difference. But it seems to me that there's this difference in piety between the way the old American Lutheran Church people look at particularly worship and the way the old LCA Lutheran Church in America people look at worship. And that was what I wanted to bring up today. Whether it's worth bringing up or not, I don't know. And I don't want to sound like, I have the right answer and you have the wrong answer. But it's been bugging me for 30 years.
Is that why you moved to Canada? Is that why you moved to Canada?
Yeah, that's right. Well, we see it in Canada too, as a matter of fact. The Canadian church is an amalgamation of previous ELC, as they called it, ALC related, and LCA related. And those two bodies just look at things differently. And let me leave it at that. And I see some changes. Let me point out a change. When I first came here, almost every time that I've been here, it's been as a teacher on the teaching staff. And I would suggest a title like this, Worship and Its Arts. And the powers that be here, who are not the same as the powers that be now, the powers that be at Holden Village in those days would say, hey, you surely don't mean worship and its arts, you mean faith and art. So that's the way it would appear, faith and art. And I could live with it, but I still talked about the same stuff I'm talking about now. In any case, this year, I proposed to the director of, what did he call it, staff?
Program director.
What?
Program director?
The program director, that's it. Paul Olson, he's your pastor. Worship and its arts. And he said, sure, we'll go with it. So I think that represents a breakthrough, if I may put it that way. And I do see now a slight, more hospitable, the possibility of a more hospitable view of my crazy Northeastern LCA background view of things.
Paul's not a pastor, he's an English professor, so maybe that's his crazy thinking.
Say that again?
I say Paul is an English professor, he's not a pastor.
Ah, okay.
So maybe that's why.
That could account for it. Maybe so. Anyhow, let me leave it at that. And I do love Holden dearly, and I would not want to offend its history or its present incarnation. Well, tomorrow we will take up architecture. And what the arrangement of a church tells, the word that the arrangement speaks. And I'm going to argue that a Gothic-type building sends three unfortunate signals. Think about that. Let's quit.
Thank you.